Then Dick Cheney made some brief remarks. He recalled discussing plans with President Bush at the same time 4 years earlier. "I remember our conversation coming off the recount of 2000 about whether to trim the cells," the vice president said. "You said it was not an option, and it paid off. This time around, the mandate was clear." The narrowness of the victory, one of the smallest margins for any reelection bid in presidential history, went unnoticed in the talk of a mandate. Cheney added that the next 4 years were an opportunity to complete the task. The conversation turned to Iraq. "Iraq is foremost in our minds," Secretary Powell said of the State Department. "We are working toward elections in 05. The insurgency must be put down, particularly in the Sunni triangle." The president interjected. "It was a defining moment in Afghanistan when elections took place. You've got to have faith that people want to be free, even in impoverished areas. Iraq will change the world." But he acknowledged, achieving the results you want can sometimes be ugly. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld referred to military families and parents. "I kept thinking about them," he said. "The election ending must be enormously reassuring to them." He talked about how the Iraqi people were resisting intimidation amid the tough stuff they faced, vaguely alluding, like Powell, to the chaotic and deadly situation in areas like Fallujah, where terrorists and insurgents were causing mayhem. And he also stressed the importance of the upcoming January Iraqi election to elect a transitional National Assembly. The president agreed. "Elections are important," he said. "It forces people to make a choice. Either they miss the train or get on the train of democracy." Bush added that he had spoken with Iraqi leaders Yawar and Alawi about the U.S. election results and said they were relieved about Bush's victory. "They were toast if you lost," Rumsfeld said. "French toast," replied Bush to a burst of laughter in the room. The victory speech and cabinet meeting made Bush's state of mind crystal clear to anyone who knew him. He was dead set on pushing ahead aggressively, selling his big ideas, and leaving his mark on history. The election, he believed, had validated his first-term policies, including the decision to invade Iraq, and it had given him a mandate for the second-term agenda he'd outlined. Now, all he had to do was what he did best: campaign. He would travel the country, shaping the media narrative to his advantage and winning the battle for public opinion one voter, one poll, one state at a time. Soon, Congress would be forced to come to the table and negotiate on Bush's terms. Bipartisan give and take and compromise from the outset would be unnecessary. Those techniques, so vital to Bush's success in Texas, were irrelevant to the Washington game. The same spirit was obvious in Bush's first post-election news conference. He expressed his intent to spend his political capital in pursuit of an ambitious agenda, beginning with overhauling Social Security. When pressed about working with Democrats, Bush said he was willing to do so. He even made passing reference to the theme of uniting the country, on which he'd run 4 years earlier. "One of the disappointments of being here in Washington is how bitter this town can become and how divisive," said Bush. "I'm not blaming one party or the other. It's just the reality of Washington, D.C. Sometimes exacerbated by you, the media, because it's great sport. It's entertaining for some. It also makes it difficult to govern at times. But nevertheless, my commitment is there to work with Democrats." But Bush also made it clear that if he had to push something through with little Democratic support, as he'd done with the Medicare prescription drug bill, he would do that. "Results really do matter," he said, and it was clear that for Bush, results meant getting his agenda through the way he and Rove envisioned it, not a watered-down version tainted by Democratic input. In hindsight, the commitment to transcending partisanship was largely perfunctory. Of course, Iraq was still a top priority. In his press conference, the president articulated the same view he and his national security team spoke about in private. It was just a matter of time before democracy took hold in Iraq. Then Iraqis would step forward and assume responsibility for their own security, and the drawdown of American troops could begin in earnest. The upcoming January elections were being viewed as a milestone moment in this process. "We will work with the Alawi government," Bush said, "to achieve our objective, which is elections on the path to stability, and we'll continue to train the troops. Our commanders will have that which they need to complete their missions." It was all part of Bush's idealistic vision of Iraq as a launching pad for transforming the Middle East. He defended that vision in his press conference. "There's a certain attitude in the world by some that says that it's a waste of time to try to promote free societies in parts of the world, he said. I've heard that criticism. I just strongly disagree with those who do not see the wisdom of trying to promote free societies around the world. If we are interested in protecting our country for the long term, the best way to do so is to promote freedom and democracy. The agenda for the second term was nothing if not ambitious: to reform some of America's biggest and most controversial domestic programs, to create the conditions for a lasting Republican majority, and to simultaneously bring a major foreign war to a successful conclusion, thereby beginning the transformation of a volatile region into an oasis of peace and democracy. But Bush and those of us on his team were confident. We put faith in the president's hands-off leadership style, which left many of the crucial details to his trusted team of subordinates. Unlike Presidents Johnson and Carter, who'd gotten lost in the weeds thanks to their penchant for micromanaging, Bush would stick to the big picture and so achieve success on multiple fronts at once. Bush's top policy and strategy advisors believed they understood the reality of how to win the Washington way, but was their self-confidence in our mandate illusory? Had they succumbed to one of the perennial dangers faced by successful campaigners, believing their own spin and ignoring just how shaky public support was for Bush? The next couple of years would tell the tale. For now, an eager and determined Bush and a re-energized White House team were triumphantly charging forward. Bush left for Camp David with Mrs. Bush that Thursday afternoon to clear his head and relax after a grueling campaign. But he would also begin serious discussions with Andy Card about the cabinet and White House staff. A number of cabinet members were planning on leaving, and Andy would encourage a few others to see the benefits of submitting resignation letters rather than waiting to be dismissed. Periodic change is critical to any effective White House. A president needs a diversity of advice that is informed, honest, and clear-sighted. Fresh blood can help keep these sources vibrant and energetic. Furthermore, working as a member of the senior White House staff is all-consuming and exhausting, a well-worn path to burnout. And the longer you remain inside the White House bubble, the harder it becomes to see things clearly and objectively. So knowing when and how to implement change is critical for a president and his chief of staff. Andy Card understood all this. He'd warned many of us future West Wingers from the outset that one of the most important things we needed to know was when to leave. Now he set out to Camp David to encourage the president to start this process by bringing in a new chief of staff. I stayed in close contact with Andy throughout the planning period. The Washington rumor mill was already beginning to speculate about the changes to come, and I didn't want to be blindsided at a press briefing by any sudden moves. At the same time, I understood that this would be a tightly compartmentalized process. The president believed in keeping plans confidential until they were finalized. Andy and the president would seek ideas from trusted advisors. The White House counsel's office would quietly vet any potential new faces. Specific names would usually circulate within the inner circle, which is when I would usually find out, if not from the president himself. The goal was to make most of the changes around the same time and to have a complete second-term cabinet in place before the end of the year. On Friday at Camp David, the president also participated in a national security meeting on Iraq. Via secure video conference, General Abizaid, the head of Central Command, General Casey, the head of the Iraqi theater, and John Negroponte, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, offered their perspectives. A priority topic of discussion was the situation in the city of Fallujah, an area of concern ever since the end of the first battles there months earlier. Insurgents still controlled the city, and Bush and his team had decided that they must be defeated once and for all before the upcoming elections. That first week in November, Prime Minister Maliki had publicly warned the insurgents that their window for reaching a peaceful settlement with the government was closing fast. U.S. forces had already begun pounding the city with airstrikes and artillery fire. Now, American forces were about to be joined by Iraqi forces in bloody, intense urban warfare under the name of Operation Phantom Fury. They would gain firm control of the city within several days and move to mop-up operations by the middle of the month. But during that same period, increased violence broke out in other parts of Iraq, such as the city of Mosul. It was the beginning of what some have called the whack-a-mole period of the battle against insurgents. Knock them down in one place, and they pop up somewhere else. The following Monday morning, after the president returned from Camp David, he made a rare visit to the senior staff meeting in the Roosevelt Room. "I've made one decision," he said. "I've asked Andy to remain as chief of staff." The senior staff applauded, and Andy expressed how honored he was. The message here was one of continuity, not change. "I have great admiration for Andy Card, and I always considered him one of the most honorable public servants in the Bush administration." Andy himself had believed the White House would be better served by a change at the chief of staff position. As Andy later told me, he'd urged the president to make such a change, only to have the suggestion firmly rejected. In hindsight, it foreshadowed what was to come in the way of second-term change. People used to ask me why Bush's staff was so loyal to him. I would reply, "We are loyal to him, but he is also loyal to us. It is a two-way street, and our mutual loyalties feed each other."